Okay, we're back for part two.
Part two of the Mongolian People's Republic, its history. Last time we really only were able to get up to, like, not day one. It was like the first few years of the MPR. It's like the cool communist version of NPR.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I would buy a tote bag from them.
And their membership drive. Maybe that's what we needed back in the communist era is... Kind of like Radio Free America or whatever would broadcast like American broadcast to communist countries, do the reverse, but just it's just like public radio membership drives. Like, comrade, today you can be a a friend of the revolution.
Uh-huh. You get like a little pin, you get a tote bag, you get a bumper sticker, all the swag, yeah. And you get to listen to cool Mongolian music and Cuban music and whatever kind of music.
It'd be awesome.
I'd be into it.
Let's recap what part one, the highlights were before we jump into part two, just in case you fell asleep multiple times since then. You never listened to that episode. You meant to, but you didn't. This is your first time listening. We don't want to give you homework on day one.
Okay. Do you want me to do it?
I was wondering if how you felt about doing it.
Yeah, I can do it. Okay. So Mongolia, everybody knows about Genghis Khan. But, like, there's more to it than that. and that was actually kind of a blip. Not a blip, like, it lasted a while. But, you know, an outlier in terms of their kind of access to power. Because for most of their history, kind of before and after, they were very much very, very spread out and rural and subsistence-based. Eventually, they start beefing with China because China's like, hey, we have like a lot of wars to fund. We're going to start taxing you more. Cool. We're going to send up a guy that's going to tax you.
The tax guy. Yeah.
The tax guy. You're going to have to pay us in silver. And I know you don't have silver. So you're just going to like give over your livestock, like your yaks and shit to the tax guy or to loan sharks. And then they're going to give you silver. And then you give that to the tax guy and they'll go into debt forever. It'll be fine. Anyway.
When you put it like that, it sounds like Tony Soprano busting out Davey, whatever. The sporting goods place?
Oh, yeah, 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 totally. It's very much like that. Oh, that guy stressed me out. Oof.
Oh, yeah.
So you have a bad situation there, and eventually you have a movement that is trying to get rid of, like, the Chinese in power, and they put up, what's his name? The monk guy. The fourth most important Dalai Lama guy, or Lama.
Yeah, you're thinking of Bogut Khan.
There we go. They put him up in power. It's a theocracy. Not my fave, but it's cool. You got old Tsarist Russia getting overthrown by the Bolsheviks. And so everyone's, you know, China's like, it'd be a shame if the Bolsheviks fucking came in and fucked shit up. And fucking Bogut Khan was like, yeah, you're right. You guys should just come in here and help me. And they're like, JK, we're actually here to take over. And so they take over. basically, back to square one. Like, God damn it. We just got these guys out of here. They're back. They're still doing the taxes. This sucks.
Fake friends.
Truly. Some manipulation is happening. But, I mean, they weren't entirely wrong about the Bolsheviks because there is a lot of Bolshevik influence happening because you get a lot of people starting to ask some questions, read some books, go travel, go see some guys and talk about cool stuff like socialism and communism.
Hell yeah.
I don't remember all the guys. There was a guy with a name with an axe. That was cool.
Axe hero, Sukhbatar.
There we go. I'm sure there are other names that are around, but I don't remember any of them. And yeah, they're just a cool group of dudes that eventually had to work together to overthrow random fucking weeaboo European mad baron who's like, guess what? I'm actually related to Genghis Khan. I'm taking a break from this whole Russian Civil War thing, clearly on the side of the whites, to go take over Mongolia. Because, you know, you only live once. So
yeah, as a fellow white himself. Mm-hmm. From Austria-Hungary.
Totally normal. Which, just what you I do. Mean,
definitely a lot of Austro-Hungarians descended from Genghis Khan, but like not enough to be in charge of Mongolia. That's
he didn't crazy. Have the genetic science to back that up. He was just crazy.
We're not monarchists in the first place, but if you're going to do it, you need a more legitimate claim than that.
Yeah, he was very early on the everyone's related to Genghis train. So
He had like 23andMe's from the future.
yeah, that's what it was. He gets over there and he's like, hell yeah, I'm gonna take over. And he does, but then he like puts the fucking Boga Dakan guy back in power. Mm-hmm. So he's not even in power. And then that's when the communists are like, all right, this is a step too far. And so they get rid of him.
Yeah, this guy, he's a counter-revolutionary asshole. We need to get rid of him because he's crazy and he, you know, has killed a lot of our troops. So
not a good look. So they get rid of him, right? Is that where we ended?
Yeah. They drive out the Mad Baron, Ungern. That's the Red Army and the Mongolian People's Party, who's formed the Mongolian People's Army, you know, the military branch.
Oh, that's right, because they only had like fucking 20 people, and then they had to go well, from
we
there.
We fucking doubled our numbers. We're up to, you know. I think by the end of it, they had like 400 or something.
Wow, that's still not many.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's spread out and stuff, and yeah, not very high population over there, but still. They were working with what they had. They liberate the Mongolian people. And then we kind of wrapped up pretty quickly with Boga Dakan.
They kept him in power a little, and then he dies.
Yeah. Dies in 1924, where they officially rewrite the Constitution and say, we were just kidding about that guy. Like, we did not really want to keep that going.
Oh, and his soul's going to, like, hang out in the parking lot for a while.
Yeah, he decided not to reincarnate. Please do not ask questions.
He's just going to take a break. It's a
sensitive subject. He does not want to speak about it. If you're his ghost, it's not his ghost. It's just your friend pranking you. So, yeah, they start setting up their new government. And I guess that's where we'll kind of pick up. There's going to be a little bit of overlap because I want to cover an interesting little blip in those early years there as well.
Okay, let's do it.
Yeah, so we're going to start with kind of a big picture, the big picture section, because this is going to be stuff that starts at the beginning and carries on throughout the socialist project in Mongolia. What we want to talk about here are big changes that they make. Up at the top of episode one, we were kind of contextualizing, like, why are we talking about this? And when we were teasing the episode two, you know, one of the big things to learn from the experience of Mongolia is how much socialism can do for people. How much specifically, not just like dabble here socialism, but like, you know, a little bit of sock dem stuff, but
whole
like
hog.
Yeah, literally gaining control of the government with a communist party trying to do socialism to get to communism. If you're doing that,
big changes are happening.
Yeah, big changes happen. I mean, obviously, we know the situation in the Soviet Union, right? They're coming from the devastation of civil war on top of a country that was already like just feudalist, barely any industry. And going from that to space, right?
Insane.
East Germany, right? The German Democratic Republic, going from the ashes wrought by fascism. You've got all the former fascists right next door.
Yeah, you kicked them out.
And you still manage to do what they did and build this impressive state. And, you know, we've talked about various Eastern European countries doing this, Vietnam, Cuba.
Cuba with the literacy. That was crazy.
Yeah. You know, to go from, you know, centuries of being held in plantation servile status, you know, to being able to do that.
I think what's impressive to us with these stories is the rapidity and the circumstances under which they still manage that. And it makes me curious about like other case studies, like in, you know, capitalist countries. Like, I think I'm kind of talking on my ass here, but like, maybe that's like more of a gradual change. Like, you never really hear about that with America. Like, oh, our literacy jumped up a whole bunch. Like, it seems like it's much more gradual and it's not across the board, you know?
100%. Yeah. It's super slow. All right. It's very regional.
And probably divided by class too.
For sure. Like, one of the things we teach in American history, you know, you got the three regions of like the 13 colonies, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things you teach is like New England, they were a little smarter. They set up like public education before the rest of them did. It's not till like Reconstruction when the South is setting up public schools.
What are you doing? You're just literally just reading the Bible over and over, right? Like, that's probably it.
Well, you have local you know, you have some local schools and stuff, but it's certainly like tuition based and stuff. It's like take up collection for the, to pay the teacher, and it's very voluntary and stuff like that. But it's just, it's so scattered, and you have to be wealthy enough to access that. And I guess I would also contrast not just the inequality and the slow pace within that society, but the external factors as well. Like the US and, you know, capitalist countries are doing that while like benefiting from imperialism.
Mm-hmm.
Like doing shit to other countries.
They're raking it in, but that's not where they're spending their money.
Yeah. Whereas the flip side of, you know, the socialist experiments of coming out of an oppressive system and being able to build that on top of it is what's, I think, impressive too.
Definitely.
All right. So some of the reforms that they were able to achieve, we'll start kind of what their government structure looked like and things like that. They end up going through three different constitutions in the course of their existence. They're like, what is that? Nearly 70 year existence.
Wow. We haven't updated ours since ever.
Yeah.
I guess we did once when we had the Articles of Confederation or whatever, but still.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, we've had two.
We had two. Wow. Quite the body count.
So they started out with the first one we'll actually consider is the 1924 Constitution, all right, where they officially say we're the Mongolian People's Republic. We're Marxist-Leninist.
Hell yeah.
Land, water, and mineral wealth nationalized.
Fuck yes.
Declaration of the rights of the people, you know, equality before the law, suffrage at 18, universal suffrage. It did exclude certain groups of people. It just said, if you're a feudalist.
Okay, that's fine.
If you are a Buddhist lama, like a monk living in the monastery specifically, you're like an ex-monk, like several of the of the guys in the party were.
That's right.
You know, you're good. But if you're still hanging out in the monastery life, no.
That's interesting.
The context is that the church, the Buddhist church,
they owned
the temples,
right?
They had a lot of land. Yeah, they were very, they had like half the land or something like this. So they really, it's kind of, you know, considered by them a political class, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting.
If we're doing the project, maybe we're like, let's find a less religious way to do that.
Mm-hmm. They got women, though, because women were in... Were women in the army or something? Did I make this up?
No, you did not. Women were in the army as well. In the 1921, like the OG Constitution and the 1924 Constitutions, they end up with full citizenship rights, voting rights, the right to hold office.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, and that kind of trend carries forward. By 1985, if you're looking at the numbers... 63% of higher education students and 58% of secondary students and 51% of the workforce women. So
nice,
pretty much parity or above. I would say that gender roles wise, I think similar to many countries, you know, run by a communist party or not, there are sources that they don't focus on it a lot of times, but you can find some sources that, you know, say, hey, you know, we're still facing kind of de facto sexism in terms of like gender roles, in terms of household management and childcare and things like that. You know, comrades will, you know, scratch. Who was it? I think Lenin said, scratch a comrade and you'll find a Philistine underneath in terms of like, you know, gender questions and things. So they had that for sure.
Yeah. I mean, that shit's hard to undo, you know?
Yeah.
You ask any like progressive couple who's like, yeah, we're going to be different. And then you're like, oh shit, this stuff is like really hard to unlearn.
Yeah. No, it's subconscious a lot of times.
Yeah.
So that's the 1924 Constitution, a little foray into women's rights throughout the period of the MPR. Then you have the 1940 Constitution a little later, just covering the constitutional law section, I guess, the Obama section, you know, he taught that. The 1940 Constitution was modeled after the Soviet Constitution of 1936. It's very closely like.
they took the outline from it.
Right, yeah. Change the words a little bit before you turn in my homework.
Yeah, yeah.
It declared that the nation was a State of Herdsmen, Workers, and Intelligentsia, taking a non-capitalist road of development for the future transition to socialism.
Tag yourself.
Yeah, tag yourself. What are you?
Statesman, herdsman.
A State of Herdsmen, Workers, and Intelligentsia.
Man, I guess intelligentsia. I'm kind of a nerd.
I'm intelligentsia and aspiring herdsman, though.
I know, would hope that given the right environment,
I would hang out.
You know? I'd like to do all three, if that's possible.
But you got to be able to ride a horse good, and I'm always afraid of falling off on a horse.
I'm very scared of horses. They're so big.
They bounce so much. I'm so high up.
Yeah, no. Okay, I have a big fear of falling, too. What did our parents do to us?
We just fell off horses at some point?
I don't know, but like every time, like I get like a big anxiety and like... Just, I hate the idea of falling.
We were just soft babies. We didn't, we didn't go fast on wheeled vehicles and stuff.
Mm-mm, we weren't stunt babies.
Yeah. We were always afraid of that. That's my development story anyway.
I think so.
So yeah, they had, still the disenfranchised classes, including counter-revolutionaries, no votes for them.
Fucking get on board.
It's a little flexible, as we'll see when we get to kind of some controversial times, who's counter-revolutionary and who's not.
Oh, okay.
And then this constitution's amended in 1949 to include a secret ballot. I don't know what they were doing before. I guess they were just going and yelling out their vote.
Oh, okay.
Universal suffrage, meaning like basically the rest, they took away the disenfranchised classes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you guys can vote now. There are three of you. It's fine. And direct elections, which that kind of, I think what they're referring to there is taking away the, it's called the Little Cruel Tie, which was like the, think of you elected Congress and then Congress elected like a little above Congress. Like that would be them. Okay, I think they did away with that maybe. That's the only indirect part that I'm aware of myself. So that's probably what they're referring to. Then the final constitution they had in 1960, by now you had a little difference in terminology. Now you have the workers still, steady workers, collectivized herdsmen, and the working intelligentsia.
I like that. It makes it sound like they're doing more than
they're not just nerds.
Just sitting around reading books.
they're working. All right. And the herdsmen, they have a crew. Now.
I like that.
So yeah, it was a little more, socialist in orientation. They said basically we're not trying to get to socialism. We're like working together, building socialism. Mm. We've got a base. We're building on that, trying to get to communism.
Love that.
So yeah, overall their style of government's very Soviet style. You have a one party state with kind of ratifying style elections, meaning basically, your party's presenting you with a list of chosen candidates, nominated candidates from party congresses, meaning hopefully you've been showing up to the meetings and voting for people. But obviously in practice, that depends on if people are enthusiastic about it or not, which in America, we, obviously have experiences where we can tell when people would not want to be enthusiastic about that.
Yeah, right.
But, ideally, if you have a socialist government, you're going to have more more reason to show up. The titles kind of change over time, but the general structure is the same. So government structure-wise, sometimes it's called a Politburo or a Presidium, but the leadership of like the party, that's kind of similar again to the Soviet system there. And another thing government-wise is that they end up, we'll see throughout the episode, very much in what I'm calling kind of a little brother status. I'm borrowing this term from one of their leaders, Sedinbal, who we'll talk about. He kind of used this term, obviously a Mongolian, but like that's their relationship kind of to the Soviet Union is that of little brother. In the sense that the Soviet Union will kind of maintain a supervisory and at times kind of heavily supervisory hand on the shoulder of Mongolian leadership.
Okay. I don't know how I feel about that. We'll have to see.
Yeah. Sometimes it's nice. Sometimes it's leads them down dark paths.
Okay.
And another example of that is these congresses. They go from meeting more frequently to eventually trimming it down to like meeting every 5 years whenever the Soviet Union is making their 5-year plans to kind of like coordinate with that and say, like, okay, how are we going to fit in to make this happen?
Wow. Okay.
So in that sense, it kind of truncates their, you know, potentially bigger mission into kind of more focusing on their role in that, which isn't bad in itself, but there's alternatives, I think, that it closes the door to, maybe.
Yeah, yeah, I would prefer a more autonomous system.
So that's kind of government structure, you know, relation with the Soviet Union structure. Next, economy.
All right, what are they doing?
Driver of your whole country. Yeah, what are they doing? Where were they? Pre-revolution, you're looking at, literally, in terms of numbers, 150 industrial workers. I'm not 150,000, 150.
That's like half a factory or something.
Yeah, basically. They have one coal mine.
Okay.
And one power plant in the entire country.
Wow, wow, wow.
All right, most people, like a third of the male population were monks.
That's so many.
That's too many monks, right?
That's too many monks. Can the monks have kids?
Good question.
I would assume not, but I don't know.
I don't think so.
I'm just saying, people are all freaking out about the birth rate right now. Imagine if a third of the population were monks.
Tibetan Buddhist monks, phone in. Let us know if you can have kids. If you yourself have kids, you can get personal with it. That's fine.
That's fine.
If you have kids but weren't supposed to have, just let us know the status.
You could be anonymous if you want.
I don't think so. You have this large monk population. Most people are nomadic herders. Very not industrial. All right. Within 15 years of their revolution, they go from an industrial output of around 300,000 tugrug, which is their currency, to 124 million.
Whoa. Okay. What happened?
Now, I can't get you. I'm not able to. I know I like to give you inflation calculator numbers and all that.
You really do.
I can't. I can't even get a conversion rate for what it would be at that time or anything. No possibility. But I will say about that currency that they invented that too. In 1924, they set up Mongol Bank, which is, a lot of these are like Mongol this, Mongol that. It's cool. Like, that's a cool way to name things.
Yeah, simple.
So that's their national bank that literally has to establish a currency at all.
Wow.
Before that, they were initially had like a Chinese dollar that by that point had become worthless. So they were just trading, exchanging sort of thing. Not barter. That's not a literal thing, but like debt systems or silver is how they were operating. So they set that up as a one-to-one with the Soviet ruble introduced in 1925. And so, yeah, their economy massively improves over the course of their socialist project.
How do you fucking do that if everyone's spread out and being a herdsman?
Well, it's mainly mass nationalizations, collectivization, mechanization of agriculture. The collectivization part we'll get to as it's very controversial. Much like the Soviet Union, they're going to run into resistance with that. There's a lot of getting foreign influence, foreign domination off their backs.
Yeah.
They put a moratorium on paying debts to foreign merchants and firms and shit that were just ripping them off.
Good call.
They turn the tables, they start taxing those firms instead. They do nationalizations of foreign government possession and the old feudal possessions of the government, the Qing dynasty had there, and the Bogd Khan had foreign companies, any of that. They nationalize that. So that gets more industry, more agriculture in their hands. So that's a big part of it. Another big part is that you would think producing this much might be like, okay, they're really hyper-exploiting those workers. But in reality, they were improving working conditions for people. They're putting more people to work, doing more things that needed to be done. If you're talking about like wide open spaces, very few. They were building some cities from scratch. Like, they're like second and third largest cities today were not around when the revolution started.
I think that makes sense, though, because even if you're like living your herdsman lifestyle out there on the steppes, you're like, I'm so free, whatever. You still will need to go to like a doctor sometimes. So like having those resources is probably a big deal.
Yeah. The modernizing in terms of just the industrial base is important in itself to get people just more like material goods. But you're right. The like quality of life is crazy improvement as well. Those two cities I was mentioning, Darkhan and Erdenet. Darkhan was built in 1961 as a manufacturing town. From scratch, Erdenet 1973 as a mining town. Both of these built with modern amenities like power stations, high-rise housing, schools, hospitals, shops. And they, you know, they put the investment into that and they moved people in, built, you know, a quality place for them to live.
Yeah.
In the modern world.
That's huge.
Working conditions wise, a lot of people were peasants in kind of a serf relation when the revolution happens. They're called arats. They abolish that. They're like, you're no longer tied to the land. There's an 8-hour workday. That's the maximum. If you have a more strenuous job, you would work less.
Hell yeah.
I like this one because we have kind of planned holidays as teachers. The day before a holiday, nobody wants to be there. Everyone knows that.
It's very true.
It was a 6-hour workday if it was the day before a holiday.
I like that because everyone's not mentally there anyway.
Yeah, yeah. A little, just trim a little off the end.
Yeah.
Hello, Eris.
She doesn't like that.
You should work more before holidays.
What a bitch.
You shouldn't even have holidays. Lazy.
Ugh.
Speaking of which, paid holidays, you would have 8 federal, like, national holidays.
Okay.
15 days paid vacation.
Good.
All right, and this is everybody. This is not just everybody. The, you know, managers. This is not just whatever. This is everybody throughout. You had a guaranteed pension, which you could start collecting at 60 when you could retire.
What a early age. Wow.
Yeah. You had guaranteed maternity leave, disability pay. They had free vacation resorts that they had that they ran for workers.
What the heck?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, pretty cool. You also had free retirement homes.
Damn.
As part of your pension package.
That's huge.
Yeah. Lots of social benefits, you know, to better people's, you know, quality of life. Corporations-wise, so there were two forms of ownership, state ownership and cooperatives. So okay. To the extent you have corporations at all, they're just worker cooperatives or producer cooperatives or whatever. Their regulations were, for example, they had to provide childcare. If they were like a large enough workplace, that had to be like on-site.
Fuck yes.
They're like a, you know, nursery, creche sort of thing. It was also illegal to refuse to hire women at all, or to refuse to hire or fire them, refuse to hire or fire them based on having kids or being pregnant.
Gotcha. Okay, great.
Which does not always even, you know, it is kind of a protected thing in the U.S.
You can always find a reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how did this engine transform their lives, and how did that kind of improve from beginning to end? Now, we don't have great numbers for the beginning because shit was just getting started, all right? But if you jump in around 1950, you can still get kind of a good picture of, like, the early days. Industry was 7% of their economy in 1950. Barely anything.
That's nothing, yeah.
Goes up to 35% by 1985. Trade, 10% to 26%. Agriculture, herding, 68% of people.
Oh my gosh.
Trim that down to just 20%.
Wow. Okay.
And you're producing more. Right? It's not like you're just like, fuck it, we won't eat. I mean, you have like mass mechanization, collectivization, all that to really become way more efficient. In 1960, you're looking like 61% of workers in agriculture. By 1985, it's just 33%. GDP growth continues strong all the way through the end. Even in the 80s, when you would think, oh, they're probably on their way out or something, they're looking at 5.1% growth each year, even in 1988, like a couple years before they transition.
Wow, that's crazy. I mean, like, God, I mean, I'm more of a moral socialist, I would say, but if you meet an economically minded one, like, or, you know, like, there's just people who are just like, it doesn't work on economic grounds. Like, look at that. Maybe it fucking does.
Yeah. I mean, in example after example, if you're not saying like who can build the biggest yacht or who can amass the most millions of dollars in the hands of the fewest people,
individual people.
Yeah. Then you're going to say, well, who can actually produce the most wealth that people get to use?
Yes. Oh, God. There's so much of our economy is now is tied up in nothing.
Yeah. Like the name of the game is putting it behind a wall and making you, you know, mortgage your life for it. So economics wise, big booms. All right. What else? Transportation. 1929, they set up the Mongol Trans Council.
Oh, hell yeah. I know you would like that one. I would love to be on that. I'm not Mongol, but I got the second half down pretty good.
Now, this was actually about transportation, obviously.
I get it.
First public bus route they set up then. They expand on that, obviously, throughout their time. They also build a major railway, the Trans-Mongolian Railway. Construction on, like, the railroad part of that in Mongolia, they're kind of connecting it to part that's in Russia.
The Trans-Siberian?
Yeah. So it connects to Ulan-Ude in Russia. It connects that to Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia, and then connects that all the way to China.
Cool.
To Jining. So it's got 60 stations, over 1,300 miles, all that built to kind of connect the country together. They set up, you know, their national airline system in the 50s. Again, very rural, very kind of disconnected place before the revolution. They're able to modernize. Urban planning. Before the revolution, most people lived in gurs, which most other countries call yurts. It's the same thing.
Okay.
They have to build kind of a huge housing project across the country to house people with modern amenities, with indoor plumbing and kitchens and everything else. So they kind of do like the Soviet Union does, mass-produced, prefabricated houses, either high-rise, which is kind of concentrated in like the capitals, with elevators and stuff, or walk-ups, like in the Soviet Union, how they had the Khrushchevinas and stuff, the five-story walk-ups and stuff. They have that similar prefab style. Similarly, they design their districts. So you have like the provinces, like the states, and then you have districts, like smaller subdivisions within that, to have like amenities in them. So each one like would have a hospital, would have a school, because it's so, again, it's so spread out. Even today, they really, there's large portions of it that don't have like paved roads and stuff. You have to have things kind of close by you, you know, to have a good standard of living. Urban areas were planned, you know, the new socialist government and everything, planned them with green spaces in mind.
Nice.
More so than we can say in a lot of places here. So urban planning was improving, housing was improving, education, a big deal from day one. Communist parties, they're always focused on the youth, and Mongolia was no different. So the Mongolian People's Party, they set up their own youth branch. Their version of the Young Pioneers was the Mongolian Revolutionary Youth League.
That's a cool name.
Yeah, Revolutionary Youth. So that's like August 1921, like during the revolution.
While we're here, you kids do something.
Yeah, it was comrades kept bringing their kids to the meeting, so they were like...
Yeah, like, come on, we got to put you guys to work or something.
They opened their first primary school in the old capital of Urga in November 1921, fresh off the revolution success. First primary school opened, the first secondary school 2 years later in the capital as well. They set up a ministry of education. They come up with a 10-year plan for education, like mapping that out overall, and for teacher training as well. And they put together a campaign of a national effort to build more schools and to do a literacy campaign. Classic communist move here.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that communists like people to read? So weird.
I know, right? Those menacing, awful commies always coming to try to teach your kid to read.
It seems like one side likes books and the other really doesn't.
It's weird.
Coincidence?
I don't know. Books for heat sources.
Yeah. They see it more as a fuel.
Mongolia goes from about 10% literacy pre-revolution. Pretty much all the education is run by the monasteries at that point. It takes them to get to full literacy till 1968. from 10% in 1921
wow.
to full by 1968.
Wow.
One of the things that helped do that was replacing the traditional Mongolian script with Cyrillic. In the 1940s, oh. it takes them a little while, but they transition to Cyrillic. And nowadays, most things you see in Mongolia, they have, you know, well, Russian letters. To most people think of that as Russian. Cyrillic, you'll see those letters.
I didn't know that. Interesting.
Yeah. So education-wise, big strides. Science-wise, they set up a National Archives in 1927. In 1961, they set up an Academy of Sciences to kind of work with other communist states, other socialist states, kind of coordinate their scientific kind of missions and stuff like that. And they take part. They're kind of partners with the Soviet space program.
Cool.
Question. In the history of the world, citizens of 47 countries have flown in space. Obviously, you can put that in a list. Wikipedia has a list of, like, which country's person got there first, basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as good communists, we all know Yuri Gagarin was the first person in space.
Hell yeah, Yuri on ice.
Of the Soviet Union. And then second guy was from the United States, Alan Shepard, of Mass Effect fame.
Forgot about that.
Okay. So we have number one and number two. Which place do you think Mongolia is?
Oh my gosh.
On the timeline of space by nationality.
I'm going to guess like five.
You think they're fifth?
I don't know. I'm being ambitious here.
All right. Well, that's pretty good. I think that's way higher than I would have guessed. Like, without knowing, I would be like 30.
Yeah, I would not have guessed that high normally, but.
But obviously I'm bringing it up on the show, so it is remarkable. They were 10th.
10th is pretty good.
And 1981.
Well, I thought maybe they like sent one over to go up with the Soviet Union or something.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. So this is what happened. Yeah.
Okay.
yeah. This was in one of the Soyuz missions in 1981. Soyuz 39. The cosmonaut in question from Mongolia, Jugdur Demindin Gurakcha. So, you know, you go from 10% of your people are able to read.
To going to literal space.
Yeah.
Incredible. Like, I don't know. As always, whenever we kind of go through these list of accomplishments, I'm like, man, imagine if our government did one of those things today. We'd be like, holy shit, you're building urban housing with green spaces that people can just have? Like, oh my gosh, you know?
Yeah, we're so starved. Like, we just want a little bit. Like, please.
A crumb. Yeah. Like, oh, you started a science center? Sick. Like, you're actually going to fund them? Cool. Yeah, I love that.
Going to give, like, adequate money to public schools. Not even build new ones or anything else. Just
give them the money.
The bare minimum.
Yeah, it's really sad. And I don't know, even with, like, thinking about like the urban housing thing, like you always see like those buildings are often shot very ominously mm-hmm. in a photograph of like, look how sad it is, but it's like, it's for free.
Yeah.
And also like, I think a lot of times those are posted from people who don't live in cities, because it's like, if you live in a city, you don't really care as much about your apartment. Like, you want it to be nice, but like, you're going places. You're out all the time, you know?
Yes. Part of the architecture of a place is aesthetic. And one, that's like a lot of that is taught to us in terms of what is your aesthetic taste of buildings. And brutalism can be...
It's a thing.
Yeah. It can look really great if you have a taste for it, you know?
Yeah.
I think it looks cool. But aside from that, architecture doesn't just involve like the aesthetics of the building. Specifically, I mean, it's the aesthetics of the city overall. It's also beyond aesthetics, like the function of the city and the different places that you go to, your interaction with other people there as well. Like, that's facilitated or, in our case, hindered by architecture in terms of roads tearing through cities, in terms of hostile architecture.
Zoning and all that shit. And like, it's not like everyone has a great relationship with their apartment building complex and their landlord and all that shit. Like, God, I've been in some nasty apartments, you know?
Yeah.
Like, cool. They're unique. They're also, some of them are uniquely bad.
Yeah. It's very pampered and elitist too, to like look at those and say, and it may just be misguided. I mean, it's not someone necessarily acting with ill will, but to look at, you know, quote unquote ugly, you know, buildings of this and be like, oh, look at them. They're so sterile. They're, you know, blights on the landscape and whatever. One of the documentaries I watched for this, they sent people, this was a, I think I mentioned this in the last episode, the ones from India, and they went to, you know, talk to people in living in Mongolia in the 80s, and they were in one of these, you know, walk-up buildings, and it was a modest apartment. I mean, they had furniture and, nice enough furniture, and it was well taken care of. It was small, and, you know, it looked a little, you know, cramped having guests and stuff over, but they had a good time, and people there was no, you know, shoulders slumped or like, ooh, like, let me try to cover this up or whatever. They were proud of what they had.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
To host people and to have a place like this was not, you could tell this was a good, they were glad to
they
live
there. They were there. Happy there. Yeah. And that's the thing is that like, if you're in a society that actually takes care of you, I think your house becomes a little less important because it's no longer the only place you feel safe and hang out and are happy, mm-hmm. you know, like you have more options, like you have public parks, you have, you know, public restaurants, whatever it is, like you have more ways to be part of a community and to like go do your thing. And I think for a lot of us, our house is like a, it's like a shelter from everything. You know, it's like, oh, like I can take my fucking mask off.
Yeah. And get a little bit more, you know, sickly. It's sort of a competition or a status symbol for a lot of people too.
Yeah, I think so. You know?
Or kind of a barrier between them and whatever social station they don't want to be in, you know? So there's also that of like, you're, you know, sure. Maybe you're in this place that doesn't, you know, it's not a big, shiny, glittering high rise or something like that, but you're in it with everyone else. Like this is like chill and good. And like, everyone does it. Just our, I guess our housing thoughts or our feelings about housing, healthcare.
Yeah. What's going on there?
The pre-revolutionary days, their healthcare is administered by the lamas. It's like herbal remedies.
Whoa, okay.
They just don't have.
Yeah, they like just don't have healthcare is what you mean to say.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm not going to, don't email me about like herbal remedies. Sorry, I want both. You can do that, but like also let's get other doctors and shit too.
Yeah. So they start basically from scratch a free national healthcare system based on the Soviet model. Meaning you have like a large network of hospitals and clinics. You have a staff trained in Western medicine. I mean, they just build that up starting in 1922. By the 1930s, have managed to reverse what had been setting in, which is a population decline. The doctor ratio goes way up during the socialist years. Some 3/4 of the doctors by 1990 were women.
I was kind of wondering, like, when you have a population that is, like, that behind in terms of education, like, where do you fucking get doctors from at first, you know?
Yeah, I mean, well, at first you have to hire them from abroad, basically.
Yeah, okay.
Eventually, you're able to educate your own. So, healthcare, massive advancements. By 1990, they had halved infant mortality. They had reduced maternal mortality by 25%. A big part of this was the establishment of maternity rest homes run by the state, especially in rural areas for pastoral women. So that was a big component of that. But yeah, major improvements in healthcare. One glaring downside is in the rights of queer people in Mongolia.
Okay.
In the sense that I could not find context for what they did here. What was it like before? What is anyone's reasoning for this? I just found that they did this. Is that in 1961, they criminalized same-sex intercourse.
Ooh, okay.
The timing doesn't line up with anything. It's not like they did it in 1953. Or
when
they
Stalin
did
it.
Yeah, or in the 30s. Or there's no lining up with any other leader. There's nothing in the context that tells me what happened. It just sucks.
Yeah, that does not suck. Good. Okay. Not into that.
Well, we'll conclude on a high point with media and arts. They founded Motsame, which was the state-run news agency in 1921. It's like one of the kind of Russian-style first part of it initial sort of thing. So yeah, Mongolian electronic news, the first parts of each of those words. Matsame.
There's probably a word for that. It's not like an acronym. It's like a, it's more portmanteau, I guess.
Yeah, but it's like a portmant acronym. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Let us know, listeners, if there's a word for that.
There's got to be. 1931, they established their first national theater. 1933, they established Mongol Radio. They established their first film studio with some aid from the Soviet Union in 1935. 1957, they have a national symphony orchestra. 1961, I would hang out with these guys, the State Folk Song and Dance Ensemble.
Oh, that sounds cool as fuck.
Yeah. And then finally, in 1967, the advent of Mongol Televiz, the television station.
Okay, cool.
The state devoting resources to insane. Making sure, you know, people have these bleak. There's nothing there. It's just all gray. They have, you know, arts and entertainment options for them.
Once again, imagine if we did like one of those things. Like, whoa, cool.
Yeah.
A full cart group sponsored by the government.
Yeah, it would be nice. Some sort of arts resources at all.
Yeah, that'd be great.
All right. So those are kind of some of the big picture improvements overall. Now I want to get into kind of the political situation, the timeline stuff. All right. What happens? Going back to those earliest days. All right. We're going to start off a little negative. We're going to have some intra-party rivalry.
Oh, no. They all like, didn't they join up? Like they, weren't there two different parties? There was like a something hill and then somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is a great retelling. This is exactly how it happened.
Yeah. You're talking about the Consular Hill and the East Urga group.
That's it.
They had teamed up together to get things done, you know? But the chief elements of that, Dogsamen Bodu, the scribe / language teacher from the Russian consulate.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And then on the other side, Solon Danzon, the ex-horse thief turned customs official.
Yes, that guy.
They ended up not liking each other.
Uh-oh, what happened? Did he steal his horse?
No, no horse theft.
Went back to his old ways.
Danzon, he was Minister of Finance after the revolution, and for a while he was the General Secretary of the party since their first Congress.
It's a lot.
Yeah, but he loses that General Secretary position to a guy named Tseren Ocherin Dambomdor, who was a relative of Bodu.
Ooh, okay.
So Danzan's like, oh, fuck that. Bodu, you suck. He starts talking a bunch of shit about Bodu and keeps it going. And Bodu kind of makes this easy on him because he makes some mistakes in his kind of capacity in government leadership. He starts an unpopular campaign to modernize Mongolian style.
Oh.
He basically says, like, yeah, we should get rid of, like, feudal-style ornaments on our clothing, like large cuffs on our clothes and women's jewelry and long hair. He's just like, I'm not here for it. Like, get rid
of
it.
He's the fun police.
Yeah.
Okay. So what is his job?
Bodu, at the time, was the prime minister.
Okay, okay. So
he was kind of, you know, one of the main leaders of the government.
All right. And he's like, fashion emergency.
Yeah. People started saying, Bodu, more like Babu. Because it sucked. And Danzan was like, this guy's awful. He said, he's ruining our drip. Also, he's plotting against the people of Mongolia.
Okay.
Specifically, he accused him of plotting with the Chinese, with Americans, and with a strange character named Ja Lama, who was a fake llama.
Okay.
He apparently, like, was not trained in a monastery. He just was calling himself a llama. He was a bandit leader and an opium dealer.
Whoa.
Stationed kind of up in the hinterlands. He would just, like, rob people. But he was very charismatic, so he had kind of a following. And so he's like, yeah, he's teaming up with Ja Lama and some other, you know.
Ne'er-do-wells.
Yeah. Now, there's not really evidence that this was happening. The only evidence, that said, there were very poor records at the time. But the only evidence we kind of have is that Bodu does pretty quickly resign. And the other part of the evidence, I think, is that Danzan not really content with that, keeps up the pressure, keeps accusing him and saying, you know, nah, bitch, you did this. And this pressure ends up leading to Baudu's arrest, the uncovering of 14 other suspected plotters, and their execution.
Whoa.
In August of 1922.
Okay, damn. I mean, was the U.S. fucking around in there yet? Are we going to? Spoiler.
It doesn't seem like, in this case, no. And it doesn't seem like there's actually government efforts to do so, even later on.
Wow, okay. We stuck out of this one. We're like, that's pretty far away. I'm good.
Yeah, what do we get out of that? This is all kind of too much for the hero, ex-hero, Suk Batar. This is too much drama between his friends.
And what role does he have?
Suk Batar, by this point, he was Minister of War.
So he comes and he's like, guys, fucking calm down.
No, I mean, like, Badu's already dead.
Oh, that's true.
But he's hearing about this, you know, his comrades going at each other's throats. And again, these early days, they're very poorly documented. What we have is he suffered some sort of a breakdown on Valentine's Day, 1923.
We're
not really sure what that, I couldn't find what that looks like, but he ends up dying 6 days later. He's 30 years old.
What the fuck? That's really young.
Yeah.
Do you think it's like kind of sus? Do you think like maybe fucking, what's his name, took him out?
It is kind of sus.
Okay.
So it's suspicious enough to spawn rumors. Now, no one's sure what happened. You get anything from like, oh yeah, you know, he was in the cold rain too long and got pneumonia and died, to maybe Danzan poisoned him. But nothing's been proven.
I mean, it's not a good look. He ran one guy out and executed him, and then the other guy gets mysteriously killed. Like, that's weird.
It is kind of weird. Danzan, for his part, goes on to cause more problems later on. He's kind of a bit right-wing, like, he's within communism. He's not, like, really right-wing. But he's a bit resistant toward Soviet advisors there. And he's a bit right-wing. So this is not a good look at all. He ends up doing some work at some point for this American-Mongolian auto company, which is a strange
business
proposal. But whatever. This gets him in trouble because this American businessman gifts him a Harley Davidson motorcycle.
Holy shit.
And I guess he starts riding it around or something.
And everyone's like, where'd you get that, bro?
Yeah. And so they're like,
we don't have those here.
You're kind of corrupt. You have bourgeois interests. They arrest him for that.
Yeah.
And they end up executing him in 1924.
Okay. Wow. We're doing a lot of executions already. Wasn't expecting it this early in the game.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess actually that's probably when you should expect it.
When things are still kind of bloody.
Uh-huh.
Suk Batar, for his part, ends up becoming the namesake of the capital city, Urga, is renamed Ulaanbaatar, or Red Hero.
Hell yeah, dude.
For him, which is dope as fuck. We should have more
really cool
cities called Red Hero.
That's sick.
A little bit of a bloody start for the Mongolian People's Republic.
Lots of twists and turns there. Drama.
All right, policy-wise, what do they start out with? So they start out with something kind of similar to the Soviet Union's new economic policy, or NEP, which is where they have a little bit of capitalism going on.
That's right.
With the kind of government supervision. It's mostly because, like, a lot of the leadership at that time was mostly nationalist. Like, they wanted national liberation. There wasn't a whole lot of focus on, like, specific communist radical kind of changes, especially economically. They're more focused on just kind of building up productive forces, that sort of thing. The slogan at the time, I think, was fairly awful. It was, get rich.
Ooh, I don't like that.
Get rich.
Unless they mean like in a chocolate cake.
Yeah, make your dishes richer, please.
Rich, like, yeah, seasoned. Add more butter.
So this happened for a little while, but by 1926, there were signs of change. The Fifth Party Congress called for restrictions and more nationalizations of private property.
Okay. Well, I'm confused. I thought the guys that kicked out the baron, I thought they were communists. Where'd they get these nationalists from? Was that one of the groups?
Yeah, one of the factions.
That's right.
East Urga. group.
That's
Dan Zan's group was a little bit more nationalist, and this just means they were a little less like progressive, maybe. They were a little, you know, less theory guys.
We just want independence. We're not here for that.
Yeah. I mean, they were communists in a way, but not like hardcore theory guys. They were more like, they were more open, not open-minded, but like, they just, you know, they saw communism in more of a liberatory sense and less so of the economic theory part of it.
Okay, okay.
They were more just like, yeah, it's underdog shit, you know, that's us. So they have the slogan, get rich. But things start to change. The party Congress starts to kind of shift and say, maybe we should be doing all that.
Yeah.
And the Soviet Union, their advisors are kind of starting to say like, no, don't do that, dude.
No, that's not really on brand.
In 1928, the tide has shifted. The Seventh Party Congress denounces the previous era as right opportunism. They dismiss some of the leaders and they say, okay, we're going to crack down. We're going to do expropriations. We're going to do collectivization. We are going to get this shit done fast. So one of the big targets of this was Buddhist monasteries. Remember we said they're large landholders. So economically speaking, they've got a lot of resources and shit. So there's mass expropriations of these guys. And honestly, the way it comes across in pretty much all the sources is that it kind of comes off too fast.
Okay, okay.
And people go at these monasteries and stuff with a little too much zeal.
Okay, there's some violence.
Yeah, and its ferocity kind of provokes more violence. People start resisting, similar to the resistance of the kulak class in the Soviet Union. They face a rebellion or an uprising in April of 1932 called the Kuvskul Uprising. In northwest Mongolia, led by the lamas there, and rumored to be supported by the Panchen Lama and by Japanese expansionists.
Whoa. Wait, who's this Panchen Lama?
Panchen Lama is like second place.
Second place Lama. Okay, okay. Yeah. So Dolly stayed out of it.
Yeah. He's okay. Like, oh, not for me.
Nah, I'm above all that.
Yeah. Too cool for Kuzgul.
The leaders of those two factions, they're like dead now, right? And then the other guy also died? Who's in charge?
The rest of the, so the party is kind of churning
still,
on through.
Still going.
Yeah, through different, not super important
leaders. Okay, okay. You'll tell me when it's important.
Yeah, they're still filling in the party leadership roles of prime minister and this and that and other. The prime ministers, honestly, at this point, I think are kind of weak. They don't set a whole lot of policy and they get quickly overthrown anytime shit doesn't work out. The Soviets are like, not that guy, he was bad. There's rumors about this. There's no, it seemingly either that's not true or it's unproven.
The Lama involvement.
Right.
And what was it, supporting the Japanese expansionist thing?
Yeah. So like Imperial Japan, they were like, maybe they're supporting this shit.
Oh.
And so people in those provinces rise up. They set up their own high command. They take up arms. They burn down city and village centers and assassinate local party officials, including youth league members.
Those are kids.
Yeah, well, not all of them. So some of the leadership, like...
Oh, yeah, like a Boy Scout troop situation.
Yeah, some of the leadership are just kind of the younger members of your party, that sort of thing. Or it's like whenever we have a hilarious version in the United States of, like, young Republicans or young Democrats, and they're, like, fucking 40. 50. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that young, bro.
They're just not decrepit.
Yeah. Anyway, they start doing shit, okay. Especially targeting people who went after the monasteries like the most, you know. And so the army, with the help of advisors from the Soviet Union and Soviet tanks and planes, pretty brutally crushed the rebellion in a matter of months. It's fairly one-sided. They just kind of mop up. Numbers are sketchy in terms of how many people participate, how many deaths. In total, it's probably around 8,000 to 10,000 people who were killed in the conflict. But this is only one source I was able to find even guess numbers on it. So it's all pretty vague, but bloody stuff.
Yeah, not great.
Basically, what happens is the Comintern, their advisors in Mongolia are like, no, like, do not do this anymore. People apparently hate it. tone it down, right? Back off. And what they end up calling this is left deviations. And they say it went too far. Some of these people had bad ideas of, you know, collectivizing too soon, going too radical. And so they got rid of some guys. They purged in the purge sense of like, just you are no longer a party member.
Irregular.
Or you no longer have this job.
They excused them politely.
Yeah, the most ardent of the leftists were purged, including the prime minister at the time, a guy named Sengeltin Jigjidov. And this guy actually does end up with a mysterious death. He is the next year mysteriously shot and killed in his gur on the outskirts of the capital.
Wow.
Posthumously, he's accused of being a counter-revolutionary.
There's just a lot of mysteries in this story.
Yeah. But it doesn't ever say like he got assassinated or executed or anything. He died.
Okay.
So the party institutes what's called the new turn. No more leftist deviation.
New leaf.
Yeah. It's a little bit more liberalizing. It's kind of like if you think, oh, they were too far right. Oh, they're too far right. Left, now they're Goldilocksing.
So they're like, we're not going to kick monks out. We're not going to change up the fashion. What are we doing?
What we're doing is conspiracies.
No, wait, what? Why?
In 1933, a conspiracy is uncovered.
Okay.
A guy named Jambin Lukumbe, who's a high ranking. This guy is he's in the Politburo of the Central Committee of the party.
Okay, yeah, he's up there.
He had led troops in crushing that uprising. Well, they find out that he gets accused of leading a secret group conspiring to overthrow the government, which, again, has him in it.
He's part of the government, okay.
Yeah, with the help of Imperial Japan.
Whoa. Okay, is that true?
It does not seem to be so. No, pretty much all the sources seem like this one's made up.
I'm confused. How the hell are we actually helping people if we're, like, over here just, like, making shit up about each other and doing nasty shit? Like, this does not seem to grok with the progress that is made.
Right. The reason I introduced the progress at the top is to kind of, A, keep it in mind as all this is going, and B, it starts really early on.
Okay. They got to work out their nasty shit first.
Yeah. A lot of it kind of falls to the wayside while they're struggling or in their periods of struggle. And then they kind of get back to it when they're not struggling.
Okay. When we're not fighting, we're doing fantastic things.
To me, a timeline of all of it would not make sense because you just have to go in and be like, oh, they passed this law. Anyway, this guy got
murdered. They went back to fighting.
Yeah.
It's a very volatile relationship.
It is, yeah.
When it's good, it's really good.
Yeah. You have this secret plan, which seems kind of random, but Imperial Japan, at this point, had just conquered neighboring Manchuria to set up its puppet state. And so both Mongolia and their Soviet advisors are getting very paranoid about what is Japan up to.
Mm-hmm. Understand. What's the year again? Because that sounds like a good time to be worried about Japan.
1933.
Yeah, I'd be pretty worried about Japan.
Yeah. Yeah, they had just, you know, brutally conquered part of China. So, yeah. Now, Lukumbe, it does seem he didn't seem to have done anything.
Okay.
He was just unlucky that the security directorate of Mongolia, like, used torture in their interrogations.
And so, he just confessed to whatever.
Yeah, people started naming names. And so this kind of spreads beyond just him. Some 56 people, including him, end up executed.
Okay, guys.
A bunch of people jailed and deported. And honestly, so the numbers are not super high IMO for that.
No, it's not, but
it's not good.
Great.
But the main thing is, it leads, its wider impact is that it leads to the rise of a particular bastard. He's kind of mean, but he's also literally a bastard in the sense of his parentage. So I like to use this term whenever I can.
Yes, Matt,
it's
absolutely.
A fun history term.
It's very funny.
The guy from episode one, not of the show, but like part one, I should say.
It's Marx. He's back.
He shows up here. Korlugin Choibalsan.
I remember that name.
The runaway monk/translator/radical.
Yeah. Was he the teacher also, or was he the student of the teacher?
He was the student, yeah.
That's right, that's right. Okay.
And so he's involved by this point. Now, he had had an interesting story since the revolution. He went from deputy chief of the army and chairman of the youth league, but his career had kind of stalled out. He was a hard drinker. He had a bad temper. He was womanizing left, right, and center. Party boy. Right? And this was kind of holding back his career. At one point, they demoted him to museum director.
That's a pretty far fall from grace there. From almost head of army to running a museum. And I'm imagining like it's a dinky museum too, you know? like here's our bottle cap collection.
Right. Here's a rifle. Like, that was mine in the revolution. That would suck.
Imagine that, like, if your field trip was to there and you're like, is that fucking 12%? Like, are you sure? And everyone's like, no, there's no way.
Yeah, why would he be here? Yeah. So, okay. He was struggling, but he has a strange turn of events here that actually works out for him. One, he gets nabbed in this, what becomes called the Lukumba affair. He gets named as being somehow involved. They call him into Moscow. They say, what the fuck? What are you doing in this? What's your role? Tell us now, right? And he cooperates fully. He's like, it wasn't me. You can trust me. I'm a good guy. But you know, I'm Mongolian. Like, you don't have to talk in Russian to these guys anymore. Like, I'll talk to him, and like, we'll make sure that they tell you the truth. These other guys that you rounded up with me.
Wait, they're sending people that got rounded up in this to Russia?
Yeah, some of them. Some of them they were interrogating there. Some of them were sending to the NKVD in the Soviet Union to question them there. And so he works with those guys, with the secret police there, to interrogate and use torture to interrogate his fellow Mongolians there into giving some good, you know, confessions and stuff. And so they end up, you know, telling the full, probably made up story of this. It doesn't implicate him whatsoever. So he ends up in the clear. He ends up proving his loyalty and proving to Soviet leadership and all the way up to Stalin that he can be trusted.
He's your guy.
Yeah. And so Stalin goes on to pressure the prime minister, a guy named Pelejdin Gendin, to make Choibilsen his deputy. Okay. He was kind of like, no, I don't want him as my deputy. But Stalin was like, sorry, bro, he's going to be your deputy.
Ooh, okay.
All right. So he kind of sneaks his way back into the limelight here by helping out with some unsavory.
I don't like that.
Yeah. Kind of a slimy way to get up there.
For sure. Like, let me just do some quick torture and look where I am.
Not a good start. It's not too soon after that that this Prime Minister Gendin and Stalin start to have a falling out.
Uh-oh. You know, Stalin hates those.
He's not a good person to fall out with,
typically. Not a healthy communication style.
Well, what happens here? Stalin kind of feels that Gendin is not listening to his advice. He's being a little too independent, trying to do things his way. And especially about defense measures. He thought, Gendin, come on. The world is getting dangerous. You fucking beef stuff up.
Mm.
All right? You need some Soviet troops in there. Because, like, y'all got some bad guys on your borders.
Yeah, but, like, that's awkward.
It is awkward. And Gendin did not want to allow Soviet troops in Mongolia. He kept kind of postponing it.
Classic.
Like, maybe later. I don't
know. Yeah.
And eventually, Stalin calls him into to Moscow. He's like, fucking, let's hash this out. December 1935. You know, calls him in. He's going to scold him for not being a good little brother. Gendin, for his part, just completely botches this. He gets super drunk.
Okay, not a good first step.
No, he gets plastered at this reception for the Mongolian, like, embassy mm-hmm. and ambassadors and shit. And he starts talking mad shit to Stalin's face.
Fuck, that's such a bad plan, bro.
The quote, there's a couple different kind of varieties here, but the essence of it, the quote is, you bloody Georgian, you have become a virtual Russian czar.
Oh, shit, that is not going to go over well. You are asking to get purged right in front of everybody.
He went from asking to begging, though, when he followed that up by slapping Stalin.
Holy shit.
Knocking out and breaking his pipe. And then for good measure, in case he had not done enough, dropping the hint that, hey, buddy, you know, if you keep talking to me this way, maybe I just might go talk to the Japanese and see about forming an alliance over there.
Whoa. What the fuck? This guy, when he drinks, it all goes straight to his fucking nuts, because what the hell?
Yeah, he went all out. This is a classic, you know, how would you, your last day at a terrible job, how would you go out?
Yeah, yeah, he's really, he fucking told him off.
The problem is, he still works there. And so...
Here's the thing, I want a list of people who have slapped Stalin, because that can't be that long of a list.
Right?
It's got to be like his mom.
His dad for sure, but more than slaps, but...
Yeah, yeah, that's, there's that. So, damn.
I bet Lenny got one off or a couple.
Probably, you know, up late discussing shit and just like, shut the fuck up.
Yeah. Well, he gets back to Mongolia and the party is just like, you're out, bro. Like,
yeah, you can't just go slapping Stalin. Come on now. You also can't threaten to ally with fucking Imperial Japan, weirdo.
Right. They were like totally, I mean... Not just against him, like, oh, that's very scary, you shouldn't do, but it was also like, dude, that's our closest ally, like, don't go fucking with their leader, like, so they quickly vote to remove him.
Yeah, you kind of have to, like, we're not with that guy. That ain't us.
They get a new prime minister, Anadin Amar, and they make Choi Bol-san, who is Stalin's new favorite by this point, they make him his minister of internal affairs. And Genndin, for his part, is invited 1 month later to receive medical care in the Soviet Union. He spends about a year resting in the resort town, this resort town on the Black Sea, before he gets arrested in what becomes known as the Great Purge. Then he confesses to some plots with Lamaist reactionaries and Japanese spies and gets executed.
Okay, okay. I mean, but yeah.
You saw it coming.
Yeah, right. You had to know that was on its way.
Yeah.
You're like, you got a really sick, nice last year, hopefully, you know?
Yeah, just hanging out by the Black Sea, chilling, counting down the days, I guess. It was probably a little ominous.
Probably.
But it's speaking of purges that the Mongolian People's Republic at this point starts to mirror the Soviet Union in kind of a bad way, in that they do a purge of their own.
God dang it, guys.
Yeah, it's similar to that of the Soviet Union. It's got similar causes. A paranoia of a foreign intrigue, in their case, Japan. Similar effects in that you have mass party purges in literally the purge sense of just like get out of the party or lose your job, that sort of a thing. It's also got mass arrests and executions. The sources are with a lot of this, pretty vague, but you're looking at 20,000 to 35,000 neighborhood.
That's a lot, even as a neighborhood. Even if that was half of the low end, still too many,
yeah. I mean, for sure. A tenth of that, way too many.
Still too many.
And it has a similar effect of consolidating the power of its leader, in this case, the rising Choi Bol-san.
Okay.
So some unique aspects about the Mongolian purges, they have advisors from the Soviet Union kind of looking over their shoulders. The chief of these guys is Mikhail Frenovsky, who was the deputy of the main NKVD chief, Nikolai Yezhov, in the Soviet Union, the leader of the Great Purge. So he was like his second in command. They sent him to Mongolia to lead things up there.
Damn, imagine when he comes into town, you know who he is, like, oh shit, some stuff's about to go down.
Oh yeah, because he was like just delivering arrest lists and interrogation lists and shit to Choi Bol-san, like, all these guys gotta go, like, let's get them. It also targeted, to a way greater degree, I guess you have the Orthodox Church in the Soviet Union that got targeted. Here, it's Buddhist monasteries. All right, they liquidate the assets of like more than 700 of them. They end up arresting and executing thousands of lamas.
Ooh, that's not a good look.
Like 18-ish thousand. I don't know if that's exaggerated or to what degree. high number, even if it's 1,000. They also conscript into the army, lots of llamas. And the rest of them that don't get those treatments are forcibly laicized, meaning you don't get to be a monk no more. That, you know, broad kind of anti-religious element of it as well. Choi Balsan, for his part, ends up getting racked with stress over doing the purges. It's a little hard to feel bad for him.
Oh, no.
But to the extent that you can, he is personally witnessing and,
you know, enabling, like
up close and yeah, signing off on the torture and execution of his former comrades. At times, there are accounts of him recommending leniency, saying, I know this guy, we go way back. Maybe he made a mistake and talked to the wrong guy, but like, let's not execute him. Let's just exile him to wherever. The NKVD officers sometimes would say, nah, man, we're killing this dude.
Ugh.
All right. So I do get it. I mean, should not have done that. You made this bed.
You started it that way too. So. Yeah.
But I mean, I guess he's not being a wimp. He's just, you know, he made some bad choices and here he is. He ends up taking a vacation in the Soviet Union, trying to get his head straight, basically. And Stalin, when he's there, is like, you know, your prime minister, Amar, he's kind of a bitch. Like, you should get that guy out of there.
Okay.
And he's like, Amar? Like, he's with us from the revolution, too? And he's like, yeah, Amar. He fucking sucks. So when he gets back, that's what he does. Amar, pretty beloved by the people. They kind of see this as the police and the internal minister, Choi Bolson, doing it. All right. Amar kind of off the hook, even though he is allowing it to happen. But he goes after him. He gets him arrested, gets him shipped off to the Soviet Union, where he's executed for plotting with anti-government elements, something like that, something made up.
Jesus.
At that point, Choi Bolson has essentially consolidated the positions of prime minister, which he assumes from Amar. Internal affairs minister, he was already that. He's now minister of war. He's now commander-in-chief of the army.
Okay, he's doing everything. Jesus. Okay, what now?
Now it's time to bring an end to the purges.
Okay, good. I guess there's no one left.
Yeah, kind of. He's replaced a lot of, you know, anyone who was challenging him with people who didn't. Brings about an end to the purges in April of 1939. Declares them to be excesses. We got a little carried away. Oops. My overzealous officials went kind of crazy. They themselves get arrested and executed to kind of mop up the
shit.
Last of the purges. Okay. Similar to in the Soviet Union, how you had first Yagoda and then Yezhov, the secret police guys get themselves purged. Similar mop up here.
Yeah, you got to know that when you're running those kinds of operations of like, I do not have long for this world.
Yeah. Problem with it, kind of, because I was thinking about this, like, you gotta have an escape plan, right? But then the problem is, if they uncover you before you have an escape plan, like, you have evidence.
Your escape plan is like, your death plan.
Yeah, so so that's kind of how Choi Bolson pretty bloodily rose to power.
Woof, I hate this.
Yeah, he is, in the histories of Mongolia, oftentimes referred to as their Stalin.
I mean, I get it. It's more like Stalin was just pressuring him the whole time to be Stalin.
Yeah, sort of. Stalin's little brother, right? Now, that said, you know, he's the main guy in the party, along with other people, but like he's the primary factor, similar to how Stalin did, till 1952. So he's there for a long time, essentially from 39 to 52. So a lot of the things that we were talking about in terms of developments, you know, you do have to credit a large, you know, an appropriate portion of that to him.
To him.
And to, you know, it, to him directly, he's not moving the heavens and earth, but like to him and the government that he's putting into place, the people he's choosing.
Yeah, the party. Stuff.
So he does have a complicated legacy. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. That's how we get started.
That is rough. I'm not a fan.
Not a great look in terms of starting out. He gets power just in time to enter into World War II. All right, I'm going to go into details here. You know, not military people, but it's a pretty big world event that they are kind of adjacent to, I would say. They form a mutual aid agreement with the Soviets. There's one direct battle in Mongolia, or a series of battles called the Battles of Khalkhin Gol, which is between Japan and its puppet state of Manchukuo, conquered Manchuria. They are kind of trying to expand into Mongolia's borders, and so the Soviet Union, the Red Army, and the Mongolian Army, led by Soviet General Georgi Zhukov, from Death of Stalin, the guy that throws off his, that guy. Before he was, that, you know, esteemed. And so they fight off the Japanese. It leads to no change in territories and a ceasefire agreement between them. So it basically keeps the Japanese from continuously harassing the Soviets, freeing them up to fight the Nazi menace.
Good, good, good.
Mongolia, you know, helped them out, provided volunteers. They didn't have a lot of money, but they did provide money. They paid for like a couple like battalions and outfitted them with tanks and shit like that to help the Soviets in their war effort. And that was overseen by a young and up and coming nerd. He was like a finance guy by training.
Oh.
A guy named Yumjagin Sedinbal, who will become the next leader of Mongolia. This is where he got his start in World War II, overseeing kind of the war material efforts.
Okay, nerd on the rise.
Nerd on the rise, yeah. He starts out, like any nerd, by getting an award. He gets the Order of Lenin award from the Soviet Union for helping them out. That's a cool, I never got the Order of Lenin. Like, that's a way cooler award, you know?
For sure, yeah. Now that's validation.
And in the course of World War II, at the very end, you have another little dust-up, kind of a big brother, little brother dynamic thing going on here over a region called Inner Mongolia. Now you have to think of this from a perspective, from a Chinese perspective, to understand the names. All right. China next to it, or as part of China, Inner Mongolia, and then Outer Mongolia is Mongolia proper. It's further away from them. Well, the dust up is that at near the end of World War II, we're talking like days before Japan surrenders. August 10th, 1945, this is 2 days after the second bomb was dropped, Mongolia declared war on Japan.
Whoa. They're like, we're not done yet.
Right, because the Soviets had just done so 2 days before. Then the bomb was dropped on August 9th, and then the next day, Mongolia says, we're in. We're declaring war.
I didn't know that. I didn't know the Soviets declared that late in the game, because they had that non-aggression pact, and they were fighting Nazis. Okay.
Yeah, and so they come in, and then the second bomb is dropped, and so it's kind of like a, we are doomed, the Soviets just declared war on us, so there's a window of time when you have to know that they're probably going to surrender to you. There's not exactly a reason to drop the second bomb. That's a different conversation. Choi Bolson, the leader of Mongolia, orders Mongolian troops to move in to Inner Mongolia. All right, they're liberating China and everything from the Japanese, and he wants to unify this with Mongolia and have this pan-Mongolist, kind of nationalist sort of unification thing going on. And he puts out a bunch of propaganda for that, and then he's like, this has got to work. Like, we've been little brother, we've been loyal. Mm-hmm. Stalin should appreciate what we've done for the Soviet people. He should let us expand like this and unite Mongolian speaking peoples, you know, Mongolian ethnic groups and everything in Mongolia and Mongolia. Stalin was like, no, fuck no, you cannot do this.
Yeah, sorry.
Bring those troops back. And this starts a rift.
Ooh. Between them. Okay, okay.
After the war, they set about building socialism, all the stuff we were talking about before. All the advances and everything, scaling back the military too. Less spending on that is nice.
That's good.
In order, you know, to afford shit.
Less on the purges in the military. I'm a fan of that.
Yeah. And then Choi Bolson's time in office comes to an end. The rift with Stalin never really heals. He's able to kind of go along with him. He's smarter than, say, again, than just
slapping him in the fucking face. Yeah.
But he's kind of increasingly bitter that the Mongolian unification thing never worked
out.
Which is, to me, strange. It, to me, only comes up in the story at that point. It's not like he was always like, let's get all the Mongolia.
It feels a little opportunist.
Yeah. But he's really, you know, he's upset about it. So he refuses to go, really petty here, refuses to go to Stalin's 70th birthday party.
He puts maybe on the Facebook invite.
Yeah. Yeah. He sends his up-and-coming nerd, Seddenball, in his place.
Ooh, okay.
And so they, you know, they chat, they're friendly. Seddenball's cool. He's like, yeah, Stalin's not so bad, you know. Late 1951, Choi Balsan gets cancer and goes for treatment for his cancer to Moscow because they've got better medical facilities. The Soviets insist on this. They're like, you cannot just do this in Mongolia. Y'all are setting up hospitals, but it's just not on our level. We've got better shit, you know. So he goes there. Takes him a while to get there. That's late 1951. January 26, 1952, in hospital shortly after his arrival, he ends up dying.
Okay. Is that sus?
Some say it's kind of mysterious because he sort of, you know, was a little...
on the tiffin outs.
With Stalin, yeah. But on the other hand, this could just be
he
more...
He also just had cancer, so...
He just had cancer. It could be more like, you know, we're not going to defend everything Stalin does, but this could be a little more Stalin slanderish type of thing of like,
yeah,
everything that happens is his fault, you know. But he dies. So Choi Balsan, bloody rise, not so bloody fall, but his time comes to an end.
Okay, and now we've got Nerd Boy.
Nerd Boy, it's his time to shine / to share the power.
Oh, I like that.
Well, he didn't really want to, but after Choi Balsan died... It's similar to Stalin's situation. He had amassed a lot of personal control, run things through him. People got used to that. So when he wasn't there, there was sort of a collective power sharing sort of situation. His main guy that he was sharing power with, he kind of made a quick alliance to make sure things ran smoothly, was with a guy named Dashin Damba, who was... essentially, from what I can see, a career politician. One of the first things that they start to do, Mongolia tries to do after Choi Balsan's passing, is to try to get the Soviet Union to annex them.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
They wanted to become the Mongolian SSR.
I didn't see that coming.
Yeah. I didn't know that this had ever happened, but they requested to be annexed.
Huh.
The Soviets refused.
Why?
It's interesting what decisions must have gone into that, or what factors must have gone into that decision, but it ends up being probably a good idea. But I don't know if they were already seeing this as a possibility or not. When the Sino-Soviet split happens, you would have been looking at a huge, pretty undefendable border.
Oh.
Across Mongolia. Like, you essentially are gonna have to occupy the place 100%. Even though they don't do that, they do end up sending troops in, like, as a border, once the Sino-Soviet split happens. It just probably would have been worse if it was a real constituent republic. So, but that's the thing. The weird thing about it is, I don't know how much of that they were predicting already, or if they just got lucky.
Yeah, that's weird. Okay.
But they reject them. It's that Sino-Soviet split that ends up kind of leading to Seddenball being the main guy. In 1956, we know that Khrushchev rises to power in the Soviet Union and gives the secret speech that he tells the whole world about, and everyone reads it.
Not very secret.
He's condemning Stalin. Stalin was actually bad. Here's why. And it's shocking to people in the Soviet Union. You have this whole de-Stalinization process and stuff. You know, if you're like a traditional Marxist-Leninist or, you know, the slandered term of Stalinist for it, then you say this is revisionism, whatever. Your opinion may vary. That comes out. Damba, the guy that Seddenball is sharing power with, supports this idea. And okay. The Politburo of the party in Mongolia, they set up a commission to start investigating the purges under Choi Balsan.
Ooh, okay.
Damba's like, yeah. Fuck that shit. That was bad. We need to look into that. And Seddenball says, no, that's not good. We don't need to go turning over stones. All right. My buddy Stalin, not a bad guy. We don't need to slander him. And he starts not only opposing it, but blocking all the efforts to do this.
Shit.
Just kind of sabotaging it, basically.
That's not a good look, though. Like, publicly, that can't be, like, popular. Like, oh, you're trying to hide some shit in the purges? Cool.
Publicly... he was more like, Comrade Choi Balsan did many things for the revolution, blah, blah, blah. You know, same as Comrade Stalin, leader of our greatest ally, etc. Privately was where he was behind the scenes doing the maneuvers.
Okay.
About the, he wasn't actually saying like, let's not investigate. He was more saying like, these guys are good guys. Don't attack them. And then your, you know, your opposition could be like, yeah, we're not attacking them. We just want to investigate, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people didn't make that connection. They were just like, yeah, don't attack them. Like, what are y'all doing? So there's also kind of a personal rivalry too, between these guys, not just political, but I uncovered this, that, Seddonball thought that Damba was a dumbass.
Okay.
He, you know, Seddonball, a nerd.
Yeah. Okay.
He thinks this guy's a backward country bumpkin.
What the fuck?
He's okay. Like, this guy can barely read.
Ooh.
Right? This guy's from the sticks. He's always like shirking his duties to go hang out in the country with his family and stuff.
Oh, what a loser.
Instead of hanging out in the city with us cool kids. He's too stupid to write his own speeches. He has somebody do it for him. He's
a hater.
Yeah. He thought he was stupid, which, you know, it doesn't come across that he is. It's just player hating, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's just a little side story, but the main rivalry is the politics here. And he's able by 1958 to outmaneuver, to get the votes on Damba and oust him from the Politburo.
Oh shit. Okay. No investigations happening now.
No, they end up reassigning the poor guy to be the director of a district tractor station.
Oh, that's worse than the museum.
Yeah, like in the collectivization, right, where you would go to check out your tractor.
He said the tractor library.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Well, you know, maybe he is a country boy. Maybe he likes that.
Yeah, he said basically, you go out there where you belong.
Where you belong.
Out in the boonies. So what they call an internal exile. And at that point, he ends up the unchallenged main leader of the party and of Mongolia. So as a consequence, Mongolia ends up essentially unreformed, essentially, you know, mainline Marxist-Leninist, unrevisionist, however you want to say it. They end up keeping a statue of Stalin in front of their national library till 1990 and the Democratic Revolution.
Damn.
They are, despite, you know, Khrushchev doing revisionism or whatever, they're still pro-Soviet. You know, the Sino-Soviet split, when that happens, at first, Seddonball tries to kind of keep the balance between them. I don't want to get too crazy here, right? But eventually sides with the Soviet Union strongly. In the early 60s, they pass a law expelling all Chinese citizens.
Whoa!
They kick them out.
Damn, there's probably like a good amount, too.
I don't know the numbers, really, but it was enough to piss off Chairman Mao. He said, Comrade Seddonball is trampling on diplomacy.
Yeah, what the fuck, dude?
He essentially called him an asshole.
Yeah. So, like, that makes me wonder, like, I feel like we haven't heard a lot about China in this story where they were, like, much more, you know, a character in part one. So, like, how, I guess, were they previously relating to them, like, under Mao? Were, like, they were buddies?
They were buddies enough to do international recognition. Mongolia is internationally recognized by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, North Korea, in 1948. In 1949, by the People's Republic of China. And Mongolia is the first country to recognize the People's Republic of China.
Yeah.
All right. So they had strong connections there.
Yeah.
You know, I just think that as far as choosing the Soviet Union,
they're always going to choose them.
They're more powerful, for one. They have more resources. They not only are right next door, but they liberated them, or they helped them liberate themselves
in the
revolution versus being the guys against whom they liberated.
That's very true.
It's sort of unfair.
Different guys, but right. Yeah.
Yeah. And the patterns of domination go in reverse order. China, for a long time, again, different guys, but ancient history, were dominating Mongolia more so.
Mm-hmm.
And Mongolia, if you go back ancient history, you know, to Genghis Khan times, were dominating Russia. It went back in the Mongol Empire when it was flipped. Like, they never had a time when Russia was, like, in Mongolia directly. So, but I think that plays less into it than just they were more powerful.
Yeah, yeah.
1966, they signed a treaty with the Soviet Union to station mutual defense troops in Mongolia. They set up bases and airfields and everything else as kind of defense against China.
Wow. I mean, remind me, in Sino-Soviet split, or Sino, right? That's the right pronunciation?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. So Sino-Soviet split, we're not actually seeing that much violence between China and Soviet Union, right? It's more just tension?
Correct, yeah.
Okay, just wanted to remember.
They don't actually go directly to war with each other at all.
They're just like...
Fuck you.
Disagreeing on theory.
Yeah, and there's a lot of dirty laundry aired and shit like that. Now, they do a lot of proxy stuff, too, especially if they're backing, you know, if they're in a country doing national liberation movements and stuff, and the U.S. is fucking with people. You have rival guerrilla groups in a lot of places. This one's Soviet-backed, this one's Chinese-backed. It's messy.
Okay, okay.
Eventually, Seddenball gets old. He gets old and forgetful. Happens. And, you know, in his case, he's got a functioning country that decides after a while, hey, you're too old and forgetful. You can't be our leader anymore.
Wow, imagine that.
It's nice. It's amazing, again, the little things that we would like.
I'd take a scrap of this. Listen, I don't want a scrap of the purges and all that shit, but I'd take a scrap of the other shit. Listen, we have purges. They're just called different things, okay?
True, yeah.
Our purges, you don't have enough money to run a political campaign, so fuck you.
So you're out, yeah.
So you're out of the party because you can't afford to be in the party. And then the execution purges is just like the police state. So we have them. They're just, they're in different shapes.
Unaliving yourself in mysterious ways,
mm-hmm.
or all that stuff. He gets, starts getting old. This is 1974. He starts delegating some more of his work. He's still a leader and he still does some stuff, but like he starts delegating more to this guy named Jambin Batmunk, who is a fellow nerd. He's an economics professor. He's like, you get, you know, take some of this load off of me. Notably, he does keep purging people in a small p purge, get out of the party sort of sense. People that in some cases were his former allies, which kind of weakens his base of support because people are like,
"What'd you do that
I'm
for?
Your ally. What the fuck?
Like, yeah, that's not a good look.
How long is this going to last? You know?"
Yeah.
So that starts to kind of turn the gears increasingly against him as he's obviously stepping back a little bit and still ruffling feathers. They're like, why are we still loyal to this guy? So by 1984, Leonid Brezhnev had died in 82. And so the new Soviet leadership there, you have Andropov and then Chernenko. But they decide, Seddenbaugh, man, he's getting old. And he's already sort of stepping back. And he's pissing people off. Like, do they need to have him anymore? I don't think so.
No.
So they start talking to some guys in the party. And the guys in the party are like, yeah, we don't really want him anymore. So... the next time that he's vacationing in Moscow in August of 1984, the Soviets are like, go see the doctor. We got good doctors here. And so they do. And they're like, yeah, man, you're working way too hard. You're putting in way too many hours, bro. Like you're suffering from overwork. They say, you got to tell the party about this. And, you know, so they have a big meeting. Then the Politburo in Mongolia, they kind of quietly have him replaced. They say, you know, health reasons, he's too old. It's sort of a forced retirement. And so he ends up living the rest of his retired days in Moscow.
Oh, okay. Just
gets old and dies, you know. But I think he lives to like 1991 or something like that. So he, you know, just chills.
Pieces out.
For the rest of his time. And again, he kind of rules through the biggest part of Mongolia's history, 52 to 84, is his kind of time. So kind of the latter stage of their building socialism there. So a lot of the accomplishments there, you know, you chalk them up to him and his leadership.
Yeah, totally.
That gets us to the last kind of chapters here of the decline and fall. We're running a little long, but we'll get through it pretty quickly. The next guy, Batmunk.
Yes, what's his deal? Also nerd.
Fellow nerd. And from all... of the accounts I was able to find of him, he seems kind of meek. So he seems like, especially when we get to kind of the actual fall, he just kind of zens it. He's like, that's fine.
Oof.
But he goes along with the Soviet Union, much in the way that Seddenball did, really. But he's in charge at a time when the Soviet Union is going through major changes. He just sticks to what's working for a while. And then our good friend of the show, Gorbachev, comes into power in the Soviet Union.
Yep.
And he's Mr. Reformer, Mr. I gotta change everything, you know, Mr. All our good economic indicators are not good enough. We gotta have a Pizza Hut.
So what a piece of shit.
Just like they start doing in the Soviet Union when they start doing perestroika and glasnost and opening up the economy to all sorts of pillaging and plundering, Jambin Batmunk decides to start calling for the same things in Mongolia.
That sucks.
It's, I think, in 1988 that he starts saying, like, we gotta do some reforms. They're doing cool shit over there in the Soviet Union. We gotta be like them.
By cool shit, I mean privatizing shit that used to be free.
Right. They're adapting this kind of, like, we should kind of follow in their footsteps sort of thing all along, to varying degrees. Now, those party leaders are looking over to the Soviet Union saying, damn, some of those guys are getting rich off of this.
Oh, no.
That's what they're seeing. That's what they want.
Oh, no.
Right? Because here's another element to this, is that there are huge strides in, like, living standards for everybody in Mongolia throughout this time. But, and this is very clear, like, if you see firsthand pictures or documentary-like videos and stuff, it is still a poor country. It's very well spread out so that lots of people have a good standard of living, like a comfortable one.
But nobody's living high off the hog.
Right. It's just very modest is the thing. And so for people who feel like they should have a higher status, that those trappings of like, ooh, let's get some shiny shit, you know, They already kind of have a little bit of more luxury. And that's, I think, a big weakness of allowing more luxuries to your party guys is
they're going to want more.
Yeah. It gives them this notion they should have better things and they shouldn't have that notion.
No, they should be a regular ass person. You should be working too. Like you should be up in there and with the people.
To the extent that you want nicer shit for yourself, you should want it the same way we all want it, which is, yeah, how are you going to enrich yourself, enrich everybody? And that's, I think, a big weakness if you ever end up setting up any sort of stratification like that, or you see it start to develop. You have to, you know, it's one of the things about the Cultural Revolution, you know, obviously it had its downsides and stuff, but like there was this call to criticize the party about what it was fucking doing, and like that's one of the weaknesses, I think, of our projects throughout history.
Definitely.
Rant aside. So people start calling for reform. Batmunk starts calling for reform, and similar to the Soviet Union, things were not bad economic indicators wise. We already talked about, like, they were still growing in the 80s, in the late 80s, so this was not really needed in that regard. Like, there is an argument to be made that there's, you know, ways to develop the economy and produce more while, you know, maintaining your political system and all that, like, to some degree, but they don't do that. And so they follow the Soviet Union off the same cliff. It's a classic move toward liberalization. Their fall, so to speak, is less dramatic, though, than the Soviet example. Okay, we have an event called the Mongolian Revolution of 1990, where you essentially just have protests. All right, okay. I wasn't able to find examples of our friends in the CIA or the State Department or anything doing some fuckery here. There are things with later elections that it's like, oh, maybe they got involved somewhat or whatever, but didn't seem like they directly did anything here. What you have are mainly young people, but increasingly more and more people showing up to these public protests, and nothing happens to them. Impressive thing about this is it's pretty bloodless. Lots and lots of people go out and demonstrate. They're calling for multi-party elections. They're calling for the Mongolian People's Revolutionary Party to step down and allow for there to be multi-party elections.
Why is that, I wonder? Why were, like, regular people asking for that?
It's, I think, at this point, because you're looking at 1990 after the Berlin Wall has come down.
They just think that's the way the world is going?
Well, they've started opening up in a similar way to the Soviet Union. They have more access to media that's, well, Western media. All right. And as that's less censored, that's not just Western media, free press, liberal, whatever. It's also propaganda.
Yeah, look how fucking cush it is over here. Do you want blue jeans?
Yeah. Essentially, like, can we have more luxuries?
And that's fine.
Everyone should, you know, be able to demand this. That's fine. But they see the simple road to that, just like the East Germans did, just like they did in the Soviet Union and anywhere else, They saw the simple road to that as what they were told it was, which is let's do liberal multi-party democracy. Let's do capitalism. Let's have, you know, the opportunity to make more money for ourselves, small businesses, everything that we're preached to. Sadly, we're over here. We know the sad reality of it. All right.
And ain't that great, guys?
But it was the quote of, you know, slightly anti-communist quote, but still of, you know, everything they told us about communism was lies, but everything they told us about capitalism was true. You know? And at least that last part, hey, they find out.
Yeah.
So people are calling for that. They're demonstrating in Sukhbatar Square in the capital. Just, it basically puts pressure on the party. They grow from like 300 people to a few thousand, you know, out there protesting. And so you go from just like open elections to people saying like, well, you should plan the economy less, which they were already doing. They wanted to fully abandon that now. Instead of like, they started doing like the Soviet Union, of like decentralizing the decision-making somewhat and saying like, oh, you can like, as your worker cooperative, you can make decisions kind of based on a loose form of profit. We'll give you the orders and any excess you make, you can sell and shit like that. But you, if you lose money, that's on you. We're not bailing you out.
Oof,
so okay. A little more like kind of cutthroat sort of shit. You
yeah.
Know? So they already had a little bit, but they wanted to transition. And, you know, again, we want the blue jeans. And how does that happen? It's a cargo cult idea of like, let's just do like
it has business, to be the whole thing. Yeah. You
know? And that'll work. So people are calling for that. And people within the party start to get anxious. And after these demonstrations get big enough, eventually the Politburo starts talking about, are we going to crack down on these guys? These guys are getting serious. They're protesting. They've been protesting. We need to show them we mean business.
Uh-oh.
We need to crack down on these guys. And so they put together a decree saying, get the fuck in your house or we're going to crack down on you. We're going to use the military. We're going to use the police. We're going to beat your ass up, basically.
Whoa. Okay.
And so they get the party leader, Bat Monk. They get him on the phone. They're like, yo, come over here, sign this decree.
Here's what we're doing.
The story of it goes, and this is where I said he seems pretty chill. He's like, no, man, I'm not going to do that. His widow recounted he was sitting at home preparing for a speech to Congress. His telephone rings, and after speaking a while, he suddenly said, we few Mongolians should never make each other's noses bleed.
Aww.
He threw the phone away. She said, it's not typical of him. He was a very calm person. He then said, some leaders have come together and asked me to sign something. I'll go there and come back. And he just like left kind of in a little bit of a huff for him. But like, he's so low key. It doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's like, yeah, he was clearly agitated, but he's just like kind of chill. But he yeah. apparently goes in and he's just like, fuck no. Like, I'm not going to sign off on you guys. And you got to imagine like he didn't like this really. I mean, it doesn't come across as like he's a little bit of a reformer, but he doesn't want to see the whole system wiped out to.
But at the same time, like. He doesn't want to go smashing in heads of citizens.
Right.
Which is more than we could say for our fucking government if we protested anything.
Oh, goodness. Yeah.
We're out there calling for an end to the political system. I don't think it'd be that bloodless.
Not for long. Yeah. So instead, he makes an announcement that he was resigning and he was dissolving the Politburo. And so the Politburo, you know, they came together like, oh, okay.
I guess okay. kind of a different strategy. Okay.
They end up resigning and opening the way for multi-party elections, which were held in July. The first, you know, quote unquote free. But what they mean is multi-party elections. And that's in 1990. The Mongolian People's Party runs for that. And the, you know, opposition parties and shit like that spring up as well. And the Mongolian People's Revolutionary Party, out of the 430 seats in the Great Khural, won 357 of them.
What the fuck?
And 31 out of the 53 seats in the small Khural, which they later get rid of. That's like the Senate sort of thing.
I see.
They win the election.
Why did we do this?
Because what they wanted to do was, I mean, what they wanted was those multi-party, like they wanted the chance kind of at it, but then they also found out like, yes, you did have a lot of liberal reform-minded youths and stuff in, and people in general, in urban areas, but they raked it up in the countryside.
Yeah, because they're like, you fucking built my town.
Yeah, you built my town. You built my house. The hospital I go to. The doctor, like, went to schools that you built. Like, it's all there. And yes, a lot of that's the case in the city. But I think they had more access to views of information about the greater luxuries that they wanted. They wanted the chance of more than that. But they don't like crack down or something. They just, even though they are, you know, the Communist Party, they transition. They say, we're going to go with this privatization stuff people want. We're going to abandon Marxism, Leninism. Their next party Congress, they say, no, fuck it. We're a social democracy now. We want to do reforms. We're no longer the vanguard leading force of the country. We don't have like that leading role anymore. Like, it's multi-party. And they just support that. They just go with those sorts of reforms. And so then the dynamic thereafter, okay, Mongolia goes through a classic liberalization of including the IMF, all right, getting loans and shit because
there it is.
The Soviet Union was collapsing. So they didn't have their trading partner anymore, their main trading partner overwhelmingly. So a lot of their money was drying up. So yeah, loans that they would be on the hook for, complete with, of course, the IMF saying, you got to privatize fucking everything in sight. Mm-hmm. All your state enterprises are gone. You got to privatize that.
Austerity.
Yeah. GDP ends up falling. 1988, you're looking at 5.1% GDP growth, kind of. By 1999, that's 3.2. And then by 2000, it's 1.3. Slowing down there. The collectivized herdsmen that we had before, mm-hmm. their herds are now privatized. Oh. They're back to employees of someone else's herds.
They became serfs again.
Not basically in legal terms, but yes. There's a mass economic downturn, as you see in any country, especially initially. You can make the argument for a long term, but you can't initially, that they always go through some sort of shock treatment initially. More children end up out of school, dropping out of school to work. 36% of people end up below the poverty line.
Ugh, that's a lot.
So it's hard times for them. Again, eventually they kind of come up, but it's a vastly more unequal society.
Totally.
After that. And it's not really the focus of it, but I do want to kind of paint the picture of, like, it is in line with other episodes we've done on a society transition into capitalism, is it comes with a lot of brutality. Not the purge type, but the economic type. And so the dynamic afterward is the Mongolian People's Party now. They changed their name. They took out revolution. We're no revolutionary anymore. They end up being kind of the slow the reforms, slightly playing defense of the welfare state aspects. You know, we want to keep some of those things for people. That's kind of their thing of, like, to the extent that we want to reform, let's do it slower and, like, help people a little bit more. Some shadows of what they used to be. Versus the opposition that kind of wants to be more capitalist oriented. But it's nowhere near what they used to do. It's not as cool. But I think it's interesting that across the board, even the privatizers and everything else, you can't get them to say, like, we never should have done communism, because their country,
they wouldn't have had anything to build on.
Yeah. Like, they're all living in the state that the Mongolian People's Republic built.
Like, even immediately afterwards, they're like, we're still going to elect those guys, right? Like,
yeah, no. Their capital city, you know, when the Soviet Union fell, they started renaming stuff. You know, let's go back to St. Petersburg. Let's go back to Volgograd. You know, we don't want Stalingrad. We don't want Leningrad. Mm-hmm. Even. You know, there, they still have Ulaanbaatar. All right. They still have a real hero, you know?
Hell yeah. Damn. I mean, I knew it was coming, but it still hurts to hear every time. I mean, I'm glad you structured it the way you did, because, yeah, that was such an interesting contrast of, like, look at all this cool shit they did with, like, look how nasty it got.
Right. It was a lot of intrigue. I was surprised.
Yeah. Like, how the fuck did you have time to do all that cool shit when you weren't, like, stabbing people in the back?
Right. It was, I mean, the workload just to do that would have been bad enough, but to do that and also plot against everybody.
That's why everyone got overworked and stuff. They're like, oh my gosh.
Too many plots.
I'm starting hospitals and I'm starting rumors. It's just too much. Yeah, that's my main takeaway is that I'm very impressed with all the things they accomplish. And I would take a crumb of that over here.
Yeah.
In the Imperial Heartland. And obviously I have those things, but it's not from the government. It's just like, because I'm lucky, you know? So I want that for everybody here.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm very surprised that it got as bloody and as purgy and as, I mean, I wonder if that's part of the deal you make when you decide to so closely ally yourself with the Soviet Union, where they're kind of got a hand on the wheel, you know?
That's part of it. I think it's also one of the big struggles we have to deal with in terms of having a democratic centralist style of party organization. Different places doing it to varying degrees. I mean, if you look at East Germany and stuff, you would have arrests and stuff, but you really wouldn't have too many like mass purge or execution type things as publicly, right? But sometimes that would happen. But I mean, anytime you have like a vanguard party situation, you end up, well, you have to defend against counter-revolutionary elements, and then that can spiral into false accusations. And so you open yourself up, people would argue, out of necessity to survive in an oppressive environment. It sets yourself up in the future to struggle with this, you know, secrecy and plotting and everything else.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's just an issue that is always going to be a struggle to balance those things while we still have capitalist countries like causing shit to go wrong.
Right. They need to, you know, they just need to stop.
Can we get rid of those? That'd be so great. Everyone become communist at once. We'll all pick a day and we'll just all do it. Okay. No takesies, backsies, nobody chicken out. Like, we're just all going to jump.
I mean, May 1st is coming up, right?
Let's do it. Oh, okay. Well, I'm tired and I need a snack and I need to digest the information and food.
So. Yeah. My computer needs to stop trying to take off with all of the tabs I've got open here.
You're in airplane mode, but in the sense that it sounds like your computer is an airplane.
Yeah. I mean, I'll give her credit. She's not, you know, revving and roaring or anything. It's a pretty good system, but it just feels like a lot of tabs for me is a lot.
That's a lot. I'm scared to know how many. Like, does Chrome have a feature where they tell you how many you have open right now?
I hope not. I don't want to see it.
Just don't worry about it. It's a lot. It's an unknowable number.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for doing all that work. Thanks for opening all those tabs. Next week, we'll be shooting that shit.
See you next week, then.
Bye, y'all.
Adios.
Hey there, comrades. Just jumping in to remind you of all of our social media. We are on Twitter at Teach Communism, Instagram at Teach Me Communism. You can shoot us an email. That's teachmecommunism@gmail.com. Any of those places are good to send us an episode suggestion or a question, anything you think would be useful feedback for us, or just your admiration. If you want to admire us in a public manner, and you should, you can go to Apple Podcasts to give us a review. It is the best way to help people find the show. Love when people write and review us. Please do both. We are also on YouTube, if that's how you prefer to listen to podcasts, or if you know someone that's the only way they'll listen to podcasts, send them to our page. And we have a Patreon. For $5 a month, you get access to our notes for each week's episode, including the backlog of notes, which is a very handy resource for up-and-coming commies. And at the end of the year, all of the funds from Patreon will be given to local mutual aid in the DFW area. So, ain't going to line our pockets. Finally, we have merch. Check us out at TeePublic. You can find shirts and I believe also stickers and magnets and all kinds of fun stuff with catchphrases from the show or episode art, stuff like that. The link to that store is in the show notes, so check that out. Okay, that's all the internet. Join us next time for another episode of Teach Me Communism, where the class struggle is always in session. Bye, y'all.